Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for November 5th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, tracking cholera outbreaks, how some flowering plants recognize and reject their own pollen, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about real-time holograms from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
So there's a big outbreak now of cholera in Haiti, and I decided to take a broader look at this disease and how it's been spreading in the past decade or so.
Science's Martin Ensering reports in this week's issue that the cholera outbreak in Haiti is just the latest in cholera's new global assault.
And really what you see is that, although all eyes are on Haiti at the moment, and rightly so, but there have been many other cholera outbreaks in other parts of the world.
Are strains of cholera thought to arise in one part of the world and then spread, like influenza, or can cholera outbreaks occur anywhere in the world?
Well, actually, there's a lot of things we don't know about the spread of cholera, but we do know it cannot happen everywhere. In most Western countries where sanitation is good, you know, where we have toilets, basically, where we have clean drinking water, you don't see cholera. Cholera is really a disease of poor countries where sanitation is bad and where people don't have access to clean drinking water. It's a disease of poverty, really. And as to how it spreads, there's a lot of debate about that. In some cases, it can spread because people travel. Somebody infected with cholera can travel. But it can also be dirty water that's moved from one place to another, for instance, in the ballast of ships. Or it could be contaminated food. There's a lot of different ways that cholera can move. But the interesting thing is that the Vibrio cholerae, the bacteria that cause this disease, are really present almost everywhere in the world, it seems. I talked to Rita Colwell, really one of the most distinguished cholera scientists in the world, and she has found this bacterium in the Chesapeake Bay, where she likes to go sailing herself near Washington, D.C. So the bacterium is everywhere. It just doesn't manage to cause disease everywhere.
In the case of the current outbreak in Haiti, have researchers determined the origin of this cholera strain?
No, that's still actually a very contentious question. Earlier this week, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta made an announcement saying that they did genetic fingerprinting of the strain, and they say it most closely resembles a strain from South Asia. So it looks like that's where it came from. But how exactly it got to Haiti is still uncertain. And I should say that there are people who believe it may actually have come from the waters in or around Haiti itself. Like I said, this microbe is present almost everywhere, and it will occasionally cause an outbreak. And in theory, it could also have arisen locally.
Other than this DNA fingerprinting, is there any other evidence that the strain came from outside of Haiti?
No, there isn't really any hard evidence for where it came from. Some people have suspected that it might originate with a camp, military camp, from Nepalese peacekeepers who are in Haiti at the moment. But that has not been confirmed. It would match with what the CDC has said, that it closely resembles a South Asian strain. But the CDC hasn't made that link itself, and at the moment we simply don't know.
Is this the same strain that's causing outbreaks elsewhere in the world?
Yes, it is. This particular strain, actually we should call it a biotype, that's the official term. Its name is L-Tor. It's been around, it's on the scene since 1961, approximately, and it's been very successful. It's basically conquered the world in the past 50 years, and it's causing outbreaks in many parts of the world. Just the last decade, it has caused a whole series of outbreaks in Africa, often quite big ones, with 40,000, 50,000, sometimes 100,000 people, patients. So it is a very, very successful strain. And the outbreaks also seem to last longer than with the previous biotype, which was called classical. For some reason, L-Tor lingers longer. The outbreaks that it caused can last a year, sometimes more, which is longer than with the classical strain.
Anything else that's particular about this biotype, this strain of cholera, L-Tor, compared to the previous classical strain that's allowed it to spread so well or so widely?
Well, it's also hardier. It lives longer. It can survive longer in the environment. In water, the cholera microbe clings to tiny microscopic crustaceans. And that's how it survives in the ocean or in estuaries and coastal waters. And apparently, LTOR is better at that than its predecessor. And scientists think that may be one reason why it is so successful. And there does seem to be one other difference. With the classical strain, about half of all the people who are infected get cholera. The other half have few or no symptoms at all. But with LTOR, only about 25% of the people get sick. But the rest, the people who have no symptoms or very few symptoms, they do shed the bacteria as well. And actually, some people think that causing less disease may be advantageous to LTOR. It may be one reason why it is able to spread so well in human outbreaks. But all of this is really speculation. I mean, the epidemiology of cholera is very, very difficult and not well understood.
For those who do have cholera, what's the treatment?
Well, the treatment is very straightforward and very effective. You have oral rehydration therapy, which is basically they're little packets of sugar and salt that you dissolve in clean water and that you take several times a day. And that replenishes the fluids that you've lost through diarrhea and vomiting. And it also replaces the electrolytes, the sugar and the salts that you've lost. You can drink that, and in people who have very serious disease, you can also give that intravenously. And in addition, in severe cases, they sometimes give antibiotics. And with all of that, if that's given timely, really, most people will survive. It used to be that a lot of people died from cholera. Only a few decades ago, 20-30% of patients would sometimes die. Now there's sort of an international norm that in an outbreak like in Haiti or anywhere, that at least 99% of the patients should survive. That's not always achieved, but that's the goal.
What's been the fatality rate in Haiti for this outbreak?
I think it's been about 6.4% so far. It is often higher at the beginning of an outbreak because, nobody knows what's going on and it's not recognized immediately. Doctors, medical staff aren't prepared for it. That was certainly the case in Haiti. But from what I hear, the mortality rate is already dropping and they hope to get it down as close as they can to that 1% that I talked about.
Because the outbreak could last years, potentially.
It could. That's really another big unknown. Some people think it may abate within a couple of months, but others say, Haiti could suffer from this epidemic for years, really, yes. In past epidemics in Latin America, we've certainly seen that they can stick around for a long time. Part of the problem is that the entire population is vulnerable. Nobody has immunity because Haiti has not seen cholera for a very long time. So there's a lot of potential victims. And then, of course, the situation in Haiti was terrible to begin with. Since the earthquake in January, about 1 million people are homeless. Most of them live in improvised camps in huge tent cities in and around Port-au-Prince. That's very dangerous territory, obviously, with a cholera epidemic. Refugee camps often see big outbreaks of cholera. And so the question really is, can they keep the disease out of these camps? And if it does reach the camps, how well can they treat people and try to save as many lives as possible?
Martin Ensrink, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Rob.
Science's Martin Ensrink reports in this week's issue that the cholera outbreak in Haiti is just the latest in cholera's new global assault. Now, Science's Sophia Kai is here with a story about how some flowering plants recognize and reject their own pollen and how understanding this mechanism of self-incompatibility may someday lead to better, more vigorous hybrid crops.
Thanks, Rob. Hybrid vigor is a goal of many plant breeders, selectively mixing the genes of the parents so that they produce genetically superior offspring. With hybrid varieties of corn, for example, farmers in the U.S. have been able to produce 20% more corn on 25% less land. But maintaining and improving such crops is a difficult task with plants like corn that can self-fertilize.
But most crop species are self-compatible, making hybrid seed production quite difficult, labor-intensive, and also quite costly.
Taehui Gao is a biologist at Penn State University.
So if we could introduce self-incompatibility into crop plants, they will certainly facilitate hybrid seed production.
In the petunia, the model organism Gao and his colleagues study, the original thought was that two genetic factors, one male gene and one female gene, were involved in keeping the petunia from fertilizing itself. Now in a paper in this week's Science, Gao and his colleagues report there are more, many more, a single female gene and several male genes.
And the unexpected finding reported in this paper is that multiple types of SLF proteins are required.
By SLF, Gao means the S locus F box. Here's how it works. To prevent self-fertilization, a female protein called S ribonuclease recognizes its own pollen and exerts a cytotoxic effect, stopping fertilization. But when pollen from another plant lands in the flower's pistil, a male S locus F box, or SLF protein, in that pollen blocks the plant's female protein, allowing for cross-fertilization. Now, scientists already knew that the male SLF gene is far less diverse than the female S ribonuclease gene, suggesting to scientists that more than one SLF gene is involved. But Gao still doesn't know just how many of them there are. Daphne Goring is a biologist at the University of Toronto who co-authored a perspective in this week's Science on Gao's team's work.
So now this paper shows that it's not just two genes, it's one gene on the female side and three or probably several more genes on the male side that are working to control the system.
Gao says so far, they've found six.
We were actually totally surprised because this is the first example of a self-incompatibility system that employs multiple genes to constitute the pollen determinant.
Gao says he was totally surprised because his team's results run counter to the usual understanding of how coevolution works. Typically, coevolution is thought to occur in twos, predator and prey, host and parasite, or even two related genes.
So how did a single female determinant gene, the S ribonuclease gene, co-evolve with so many different types of the male determinant genes, SLF?
In the petunia, Gao says, it appears that every time a new female non-self sRNase allele arises, if none of the pollen's existing male SLF genes can recognize and inhibit it, a new male SLF gene must evolve to interact with it. In addition, it appears that sometimes these male SLF genes collaborate. For example, of the six Gao and his team have already found, three of them appear to work together. But not all of them did. Perspective author Daphne Goring explains.
So that means that there's probably other SLF-like genes out there that are involved in this collaborative non-self sRNase recognition. And so I guess the big question is how many are actually involved?
And so there could be many more than the six genes Gao has found, says Thomas Sims. And that's because multiple SLF-like genes have been found in the same genetic locus. Sims is a biologist at Northern Illinois University who is not affiliated with this study.
It may provide a certain degree of flexibility in the system in that if you have multiple SLF alleles in a wild breeding population, it gives the possibility of more cross-compatible groups and therefore more cross-fertility within a breeding population.
And so more opportunities for hybrid vigor. But producing hybrid seeds means two parents, and so requires difficult and expensive measures to keep plants from self-fertilizing. Genetically engineering such a self-incompatibility system into crops that, right now, can self-fertilize could save farmers a lot of time, money, and labor. Again, biologist Thomas Sims.
I think that's a lot further down the road, and whether this system would actually be really practical in that type of application or not is, I think, still an open question.
With many more questions, study author Tae Hui Gao says, that still have to be answered.
For example, what is the mechanism for the generation of multiple types of SLF genes? You could either have a single type of SLF gene that has a very high degree of sequence diversity to allow a single gene to interact and recognize a large number of S ribonucleases. Or you could have multiple types of SLF genes, each with a limited degree of sequence diversity.
Or perhaps even something else. You can read Gao's paper titled Collaborative Non-Self-Recognition System in sRNAs-Based Self-Incompatibility, and Goring's related perspective titled Pollen Gets More Complex in this week's Science. For Science Magazine, I'm Sophia Kai.
Now, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, joins us by phone with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about real-time holograms.
Well, not quite real-time, Rob.
Tell us more about it, Dave.
Well, Rob, do you remember that scene in Star Wars, that classic sci-fi movie where Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke are gathered around R2-D2 and he beams a hologram of Princess Leia in front of them and she says, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope."
Right.
Yes?
So how close are we to that kind of capability?
Well, Rob, turns out we're a lot closer than we've ever been. You know, researchers have been creating holograms for decades, but they're very expensive to make. And the type of holograms that researchers have been able to create so far, not only are they expensive, but they're usually pretty small because the film that you need to make them on is a very expensive film. So that's really limited their utility. And obviously what researchers, the gold standard is for a researcher to develop something like we saw over 3 decades ago in Star Wars, where not only is it a hologram, but it's a hologram that's moving in real time.
So making the science fiction reality, okay.
Exactly.
So the innovation here is some sort of less expensive film, or what?
Exactly. What the researchers here found is they were able to devise what they call a polymer-based holographic film that's far cheaper than the current films that they're using. And they were able to also create a technology where the image on the film would update every 4 minutes. Now, that doesn't sound like very fast, and actually it's pretty slow. Can you imagine watching a movie where the frames only update every 4 minutes? That's pretty slow. So they kept on working and working on this. They created this setup where they had 16 cameras arranged in a semicircle around a target, and the cameras would film the target every second. And then they use lasers to actually create the image of the hologram, which is the typical way you actually create holograms. They basically combined all this technology, the cheap film, the cameras, the lasers, and they were able to create these close to real-time holograms that update images about every 2 seconds.
Using the same piece of film.
Yeah, it's essentially rewritable. Now, 2 seconds isn't ideal because, again, if you're watching a movie and the frames are only refreshing every 2 seconds, it's going to seem very sort of herky-jerky and not fluid. The ideal is to get it down much faster than that so these images actually look live. And the goal eventually is you would have this hologram and you could, say, project an image of a car on a table, and somebody standing at the front of the table is going to see the hood of the car, but as they walk around the table, just as if you were to walk around a real object, you would see the doors and then you would see the trunk. And you can actually see a video of this happening on the site with a hologram of a military airplane.
Besides the sort of gee whiz, wow, that's just like Star Wars impact factor here, what are researchers hoping to do with this technology?
Well, Rob, before we leave the gee whiz, one cool gee whiz application is a movie that would be a truly immersive experience. Imagine sitting in a movie theater and the action is actually surrounding you on all sides. But for the non-gee whiz applications, there's actually some very important medical applications that come out of this. Researchers have been talking for a while about creating sort of a virtual operating room where medical specialists from around the world could virtually gather around a patient and offer advice for a doctor somewhere else in the world that's conducting the surgery. So there's a lot of really practical applications for this technology in addition to the gee whiz ones.
Okay, thanks, Dave. So what other stories do you want to talk about?
Well, Rob, from people interacting with holograms to dolphins interacting with each other, this next story is about complex social networks in dolphins and how they help them reproduce.
Why are these social interactions complex, Dave?
Well, Rob, it turns out that there's several levels at which dolphins interact that makes these interactions so complex. The first level is what researchers call a first-level alliance. And this is basically when a male dolphin's out there looking for a female, he grabs one of his buddies, you can think of it like a wingman, and they both approach the female together. And the reason they need to do that is for a male to mate with a female, he has to somehow prevent the female from getting away. And so he sort of needs a buddy there to help keep the female in place while he mates with her. And females are actually a very big prize for male dolphins because they only come into estrus about every 4 to 5 years. So it's really important for a male to snag that female and keep that female once he's got her snagged. So that's what researchers call first-level alliance. That may not seem very complicated, but it gets a lot more complicated because now you've got these two males with a female, and all of a sudden some other males come along and try to steal that female away. So this first-level alliance starts to buddy up with some other first-level alliances, and then you've got what researchers call a second-level alliance, where you've basically got a much bigger group, a more complex group of male dolphins with a female, sort of guarding her against other male dolphins. Now, that all sounds really complex, but it gets even more complex. And that's what this new study is about. It's about what researchers have found they're calling, believe it or not, a third-level alliance. And that's basically when these second-level alliances pair up with other second-level alliances, again, when this female is threatened. And you've got this very complex group of these male dolphins with their wingmen, those small groups paired up with other small groups, and then that agglomeration of a number of small groups then pairing up with another agglomeration of small groups to form this third-level alliance. And researchers say this is the most sophisticated networking, if you want to call it that, that's been seen in any animal besides humans. It's not even been seen in chimpanzees. And because of this, researchers speculate this may be one reason dolphins have such large brains, because they need to keep track of these really complex social interactions, these shifting alliances. Sometimes these dolphins switch sides when they're fighting over the female. So there's just a lot going on in dolphin society that we're just now starting to appreciate.
Are any of these alliances genetics, males with their brothers, say, helping out?
Well, Rob, it turns out that actually genetics doesn't really play a very big role in this. These just tend to be friendships and alliances, just like people would form friendship and alliances, not necessarily with people in your family. The dolphins are doing the same thing, sometimes with complete strangers. And that's a bit bizarre because, you know, we usually think of animals helping each other out only when they get some sort of benefit from it. And usually when it comes to enhancing one's chances of reproduction, you're really going to rely on your relatives, because even if your relatives don't end up mating, they're essentially getting some of their genes passed down to the next generation if you're a successful mater and you're related to them. But that doesn't seem to be what's happening here. The best researchers can figure is maybe these friends and strangers are pairing up with these dolphins because they expect something in return down the line. When down the line, maybe they've courted a female and need to keep her protected, you know, they'll do the dolphin equivalent of saying, hey, remember when I helped you out a few months ago or a few years ago with that female? Now I need your help. And that would, again, be a very sophisticated behavior that hasn't been seen in very many animals.
Are there alliances between females, too?
Well, there was another paper that also came out this week about alliances between females, and these alliances seem to form a somewhat different function. The researchers found that female dolphins tend to hang out with other female dolphins and as friends, but this hanging out can actually have a significant impact on the survival of their offspring. In fact, the researchers found that when female dolphins hung out with other females that had successfully raised calves, the original females had more calves that survived to age 3. And the researchers think that may happen because if you've got more females around you, they may be able to ward off sharks or other predators. And at age 3, that's when dolphins become independent. So it turns out it's not just in males that researchers have been observing these complex alliances. They've been observing alliances in females, too. And in both cases, these alliances are really important to the survival of the species.
Do they have any understanding of how the dolphins build their alliances?
No, Rob, that's still an open question, and actually that's the focus of ongoing research, is how the dolphins form these alliances, maybe something with the way they communicate. That's still a mystery at this point.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from how dolphin relationships help populate the species to how relationships between bacteria and flies help flies populate their species. Rob, this last story is about the bacteria that live in and on top of all of us. And it's not just humans. You know, we've got bacteria that live all over our skin and in our intestines. And these bacteria help us do everything from digest food to potentially ward off diseases. Well, flies have them too. And it turns out that in flies, these bacteria may even influence which individuals flies mate with.
What's bacteria got to do with that?
Well, it's a little unclear, but researchers do know that bacteria can play a role in the smells that emanate from a body. But bacteria can even play a more subtle role in the smells, or what researchers sometimes call the pheromones, the sex pheromones that animals, some animals use to determine who would make an appropriate mate. And so that was one possible mechanism. But backing up a little bit, this study really comes from a weird observation in the 1980s where researchers were working with fruit flies, and these are these tiny little flies, kind of hard to see. And what they did was they divided flies into two groups, and they fed one group one type of diet, and they fed another group another type of diet, and they did this for many generations. And then they combined the flies back together, and what was really bizarre was that the flies would only mate with flies that had been raised on their same diet. If they encountered a fly, even if that fly was totally receptive to mating, if that fly had been raised on a different diet, the other fly wouldn't mate with him or her. And the researchers sort of scratched their head and didn't know what to make of it. So in this new study, researchers said, well, maybe bacteria have something to do with it because bacteria might influence pheromones. And also, diet can influence the composition of bacteria in an individual, even us. If we eat different diets, we have different populations of gut bacteria.
So there's nothing about the food that the flies ate that made them somehow less fit?
No, and the way the researchers showed that was they took these flies, they repeated this classic experiment where they took a population of flies, split in two, and fed one population a diet of molasses and cornmeal, and another one a diet of starch. And for many generations, these flies were eating very different diets. And when they recombined them, just as the other researchers had shown, flies would only mate with flies that had eaten the same diet. But to get to your question, Rob, the question is, well, is it really the bacteria that's causing this and not the food? And what they did was they repeated the experiment again, but this time they treated the flies with antibiotics to kill all the bacteria. And all of a sudden, that weird effect went away. The flies would basically mate with whoever was receptive, and it didn't matter who they encountered and or what the diet was of the fly that they encountered. And so that was a strong indication that it was the bacteria and not another factor that was really influencing these mating decisions.
So the antibiotics cut down on the bacteria, that cut down on the smell and or changed the pheromones of the flies.
Exactly. And in fact, researchers measured pheromone levels and they saw that treatment with antibiotics actually reduced the difference in the various amounts of pheromones between flies that had eaten different diets. So it sort of leveled off those pheromones. And so smell-wise, these flies didn't appear any different to each other, even though they had eaten different diets when they were treated with antibiotics.
Is this kind of thing likely to happen in the wild when all fruit flies are likely to have access to the same foods?
Well, researchers aren't sure, but related to that, the really intriguing angle is that by causing these flies to selectively mate with other flies, these bacteria could even be causing the creation of new species. One way new species form is if individuals in a single population start mating selectively with other individuals in that population. And after many, many generations, when you have certain types of individuals that are only mating with other types of individuals within a population, those individuals start to become their own species. They develop traits that distinguish them from their brethren. And the researchers say something very similar could be happening in the wild. Even if it's not happening with fruit flies, it could be happening with other organisms, and bacteria could be a possible mechanism.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about a new potential therapy for strokes, and also a story about how electrically stimulating the brain could improve somebody's math skills. And on Science Insider Science's policy blog, we've got very comprehensive coverage of the midterm elections that just took place in the U.S., what the impact is going to be on science, on things like funding for NIH, and on issues like climate change and stem cell research. There may be many changes ahead with this new political landscape, and you can read all about this and the Science Now stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to a June 11th policy forum, Global HIV/AIDS Policy in Transition. In that policy forum, John Bongartz and Mead Over argue that the cost of universal access to HIV/AIDS treatment is unsustainable and suggest reallocating aid for the most cost-effective health interventions, focusing on HIV prevention, childhood immunization, malaria, tuberculosis, maternal mortality, and family planning. Donna Barry and Megan Townsend of Partners in Health in Massachusetts write in to suggest that rather than scaling down antiretroviral therapy to combat HIV/AIDS, we should ensure that the world lives up to its promises.
The authors write, in 2005, the G8 promised Africa $25 billion U.S. dollars in order to ensure universal access to HIV treatment by 2010. The subsequent expansion of HIV treatment has paved the way for large-scale global health funding mechanisms. However, the G8 commitment to universal access is at least 30% short. The global fund donations from the United States are more than $1 billion less than their fair share, and the funding for the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief has increased this year by the smallest increment in the program's history.
The authors conclude, instead of working to transition away from HIV treatment programs that have been proven to reduce transmission by 92% and have brought hope to countries once thought beyond saving, let us concentrate on how to best advocate for more funding and better policies that allow the world to fulfill its commitments and ensure the right to health for the world's most vulnerable.
You can read the full letter, as well as several others on the same policy forum, in the October 8th issue of Science. Our next letter is from the October 22nd issue and is in response to a paper by Ayelet Genizi and colleagues titled Shared Social Responsibility, a field experiment in pay-what-you-want pricing and charitable giving. In that study, the authors concluded that when customers pay what they want instead of a fixed price and half the proceeds go to charity, the pursuit of social good does not undermine the pursuit of profit, and that a company can best serve its community and its shareholders by sharing its social responsibility with its customers.
David Cleveland of the University of California, Santa Barbara, writes in to suggest an alternative interpretation of Genizian colleagues' results, concluding, the shared social responsibility, pay what you want, strategy can be most parsimoniously described as a method for companies to conceal the unequal net benefits from customers while manipulating them to consume more. It creates the illusion that the company is directly contributing to social welfare, so customers are motivated by their own social values to increase company profits through increased consumption.
More important, Cleveland continues, assumptions about welfare, consumption, and altruism underlying the author's conclusion contradict two widely accepted observations. One, increasing current global consumption levels often reduces general social welfare. And two, the capacity for moral behavior is evolutionarily adaptive, so humans will contribute to social good at net direct cost. Therefore, shared social responsibility in this time of global economic, environmental, and social crises may require social and business structures that encourage widespread altruistic behavior that is not dependent on increasing physical consumption.
You can read Cleveland's full letter, as well as Genizian colleagues' response, in the October 22nd issue of Science. Our final letter is from Chris Kettle of ETH Zurich and colleagues from institutions around the world. The authors write in to lament a missed opportunity for forest restoration in Borneo.
The authors write, large-scale restoration of tropical forests is increasingly recognized as a credible option for climate change mitigation and biodiversity conservation. To implement this strategy, we must collect and nurture vast numbers of tree seeds. Yet in conservation priority areas such as Indonesia, many tree species rarely produce seeds. In 2010, we witnessed the first large mass fruiting event in Borneo since 1998, both in geographic extent and species involved. Unfortunately, forestry departments, funding agencies, and most research institutes were unprepared for this rare opportunity.
These seeds cannot be stored, the authors continue, even in state-of-the-art seed banks. To contribute to the restoration efforts, they must be collected and planted immediately. We have much of the scientific and botanical knowledge required to achieve successful restoration. But we lack the financial and infrastructural resources for seed collection, propagation, and restoration. We must prepare now to provide funding, planning, and infrastructure for the next major fruiting event. This may be the last opportunity to collect sufficient seeds from many endangered tree species for conservation and forest restoration.
You can find the full letter in the October 29th issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the November 5th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.